Yeah, baby. It's the lightning round. Ask the inspector. We do this every Tuesday at this time. Scott Ritter, our favorite weapons inspector, answers audience questions in 3 minutes or less, or he gets the whip. And on Friday nights, we have the loquacious version where we're on for a couple of hours and it's a lot more extensive. And how is my favorite weapons inspector doing today? That would be you, Scott.
Well, I'm doing fine. Thank you, Jeff. How is the king of accuracy doing today?
You brought an oldie but a moldie out there. Yes. That was what was what did I how did I used to use that? That was like a handle on some kind of social media handle or something. Do you remember how I used that?
Don't know. That was just basically during our entire Iraq war thing, you were the king of accuracy.
Yes. I claim to be anyway. The king of accuracy is fine. So is America's sweetheart. I've got a lot of nicknames.
Leave that up to Tori and Ann and others, because Jeff, you know how I feel about these things.
All right, very good. Kevin Michalitzi is handling backstage duties today, and we appreciate that. Scott, as usual, has been very busy lately. Since last episode, he published an article about his trip to Washington. Give peace a chance at Scott Ritter Extra. That's our Substack, and we hope you'll subscribe to it. Just go to scottritterextra.com. And he also published something in Global Times about the militarization of China policy and how it's a bit hysterical from the U.S. perspective. And just today, something we've been talking about on an ongoing basis, Russophobia. And, this has reminded me. There's a lot of things that you understand, but then something comes at you and then you really grasp it more deeply. And that's how I felt when I read this today. I think it was just the last episode I said to you, know what? It is a sickness. I said, that's not hyperbole. It was the last episode, I think. And this was a very long article. You gave a lot of details and examples of Russophobia. So I'm sure we can't get into all that right now, but you want to sum it up a little bit and we can have folks read it for the full Monty?
Sure. I mean, the origins of this article are actually an essay written by the Russian ambassador to the United States, Anatoly Antonov, that was published in a Russian newspaper, which makes it sort of unapproachable by me because I don't do too well in Russian. I'm working on it, but fortunately, they published a translated version on the embassy Facebook page, and it's a wonderful essay. The problem is, of course, how many Americans are going to go to the Russian embassy Facebook page, and if they do, probably only they're probably pro-Ukrainian types who are going there to mock. The last thing they're going to do is download and try and absorb what the Russian ambassador Anatoly Antonov had to say. And let me just say this: I had the honor and privilege of not only meeting him last weekend when I was in Washington, D.C. and attended the Defender of the Fatherland Day celebration, but I had the privilege of having an extended lunch with him in December where we discussed arms control. This is a man who was the lead negotiator for the New START treaty, and right now, New START is all the rage with the Russians suspending their cooperation. This is the guy you want to talk to, and I've had the privilege of having to have very in-depth relevant conversations with this gentleman. He is one of the more cultured people you'll meet in your life. I mean, I probably made him uncomfortable with my presence because I'm literally the local yokel you drag in from the farm kind of guy, and but he was showing me his residence and naming off the artists. Iazovsky was one. He showed me others. This is a deeply cultured man, and so when I saw this article and I started reading it, this guy isn't just he's not posturing. This isn't an ambassador who received a tasking from the Kremlin to write an article. This is a guy who loves his country, loves Russian culture, and is deeply offended, I think, by the level of Russophobia. And so he's trying to confront an American audience about this disease, and I think he calls it a disease as well. But in reading it, I just thought that it's such an important message that he has there that I would try to help him out. And I'm an American who as I admitted, I'm not the most cultured person in the world. So I read his article and I had to do deep research to find relevance. And I dug and I dug and I dug. And I said, man, I did all this research to, you know, for my own edification. Why don't I share it with people? So I broke his essay down and I expanded on it. And I shared my research, tried to put some context in it. You know, make it come to life for people who might otherwise not be familiar with this. And in doing so, I hope I can take the reader on a journey of, to deconstruct this illness called Russophobia and the mindlessness of it, just the absolute inanity of it, an effort to cancel not only an entire culture, but an entire nation, an entire history that's being done by people with, obvious agendas. As I say in the article, I mean, you know, the issue of what constitutes Ukrainian nationality and Russian nationality, that's an issue for Ukrainians and Russians to work out. I mean, that's an issue of historical, interpretation and things like that. And that's something that rational people can have a rational discussion about. But that's not what's happening here. We have Ukrainian fanatics who are going in and just grabbing things and eliminating anything dealing with Russia. And Americans are buying into that. We are allowing this to happen. And in doing so, and I'll leave you with this, Jeff, you can't solve a problem if you haven't adequately defined the problem. I've been saying this for a long time. I said it back in Iraq when we talked about Iraq, and I'll say it today. If we claim that we have a problem with Russia, and let's say that we do, I personally don't believe we do, but let's say we have a legitimate gripe with Russia. Our duty and responsibility is to define that gripe within the context of Russia, the reality of Russia, because then the solution we try to derive will be founded in reality. What we're doing with Russophobia is creating fiction, an absolute fiction, and we're calling it a problem, and then we're trying to promulgate solutions for this, and we're solving nothing. We're just making the matters worse. Russia is an important nation, whether you like Russia or not. It's an important nation, and it's a nation that has a lot of nuclear weapons that we're supposed to be working in a cooperative fashion to bring under control so that we don't explode into a nuclear apocalypse. And you can't go down that path. You can't enter that journey grounded in ignorance and the fear that's generated from that ignorance. And that's all Russophobia is. So that's why I wrote this article, because I think what Ambassador Antonov has to say should be read by all Americans and absorbed by all Americans. I read it. I think people who are more cultured than me could easily just deal with Ambassador Antonov's text. But for people like myself who need a little bit of help, I provided the help by doing the research and providing some broader context for the very important issues that he brought up in this essay.
Right. And the sheer volume of examples that you give is what drives the point home. And it's what's rather depressing, because there's always going to be some unreasonable people on every subject. But the pervasiveness of it is what really struck me. And I don't know how much research you had to do to acquaint yourself with various works of art and music and so forth. But we have a guest. We're going to do our part to kind of bridge this cultural divide on Friday night. We have a special guest, a gentleman who calls himself Tim Kirby Russia. And part of culture is a bit more populist, football. This guy is part of an American football league in Russia, but he's also, like you, an intellectual. He is really a guy who has his finger in a lot of pies. I don't even know if you know about all that he does, because I found out he does a lot more than you told me. Are you aware of everything he has done?
I thought he played football. That's the only reason why I bonded with Mr. Kirby, is that he told me he played football, and I went, I play football too. So I thought we were going to get together, bang heads, bang chests, bang backs, drink beer, and run around and be real men doing manly things in a manly way with other men. But now you're telling me he's an intellectual? Cancel the show. I'm intimidated. I don't want to have anything to do with this guy.
Actually, you both have a lot in common. He has been a vlogger. He does travel and food videos. He's been on American radio doing morning shows, and the same there. He's a political commentator. He's a football player. He's also a football announcer.
I mean, look at the neck. Look at the neck on that guy. All right. He plays football.
So he's an expat. So Friday night, we're going to give our audience a chance to hear from somebody from the American perspective, who lives in Russia now, to tell us a little bit about what it's like there. So I'm looking forward to that. Please tune in on Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern time. Let's go to the questions from our beloved audience. As I said, Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less, or he gets the whip and it hurts. So let's stick to that, strictly enforced. And we'll have some prepared questions that were submitted in advance. And then towards the end of the hour, we'll take some live questions as they come in on Facebook and YouTube with Kevin Michalitzi handling the backstage duties. The first question is from Chuan Z in Chicago. What do you think is Zelensky's rationale for keeping relations with China cordial instead of following in the footsteps of the Czech Republic and the Baltic states in burning their bridges with China and supporting Taiwan independence?
Well, there's a couple things. One, there's a perception on the part of Zelensky and his Washington, D.C. handlers that it would be in the strategic advantage of Ukraine to find a way to woo China away from the Russian orbit, to create a gap between the very close relationship that exists between Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, the Chinese president. This is a perception that's driven by the fact that the Chinese weren't all on board the Russian invasion train when it first happened, even though the China talked about, having common interests in terms of opposing the unilateral, the rules-based world order that the United States was imposing. Chinese issues of sovereignty and their perceptions thereof were somewhat offended by what Russia did in Ukraine, and so there's a perception in the West that we can separate China from Russia. And I think that's what Zelensky's about, because if he goes all in on Taiwan, he can just guarantee that China is going to stop, being somewhat cool to what Russia did in Ukraine. But I think he's wrong, because I think China is now changing its interpretation away from one where they aren't, comfortable with what Russia did, to one where they've redefined the Russian experience in Ukraine as an existential war between Russia and the collective West that uses Ukraine as a proxy. So we'll see what Zelensky does in the future. But right now, I think he's still holding out hope that somehow China could be drawn away from the Russian orbit.
Okay. Just under 3 minutes. Good job, Inspector. Carol from the UK. Russell Texas Bentley, a Russian citizen who has been fighting the Donbas since 2014, says Russia has not destroyed rails and bridges because everyday Russian goods are sent to Europe. So someone has made a corrupt deal, and he fears Russia will lose if they don't attack with full force, which they are not. What are your thoughts, Scott?
Look, Mr. Bentley lives in the Donbas. He has, I think he's married a lady from that area, and he obviously is deeply emotionally involved in this. I disagree with him. I don't see corrupt intent. I think that he is somebody who has immense local knowledge, but very little appreciation for the strategic issues at play here. He is somebody who has had to live through the horrible bombardment of Donetsk by the Ukrainians, not only during the 8 years from 2014 to 2022, but ongoing since this conflict has taken place. I've seen his videos and his reaction to this bombardment, and it's visceral. He's angry. He's furious. He feels frustrated. And oftentimes when that happens, you're looking for people to blame. And when you believe that in order to prevent this continued bombardment, that the Russians need to be more aggressive. and if the Russians don't perform to the level that you expect, you see ill intent. And I think that's what's happening here. I think he's wrong. I think he doesn't understand what the special military operation is. And I think he doesn't understand what Russia's strategic goals and objectives are in this conflict. They're not to make Russell, satisfied. They're to satisfy the needs of the Russian nation as a whole. And, a lot of Russian soldiers have died. I know a lot of Donetsk militia members have died in Lugansk and Wagner and everybody else. A lot of Russian soldiers have died too. So I think Russell needs just to back the hell off a little bit and understand that it's a very difficult situation he's in. But he needs to appreciate the fact that Russia has sacrificed significantly to bring Donetsk into the Russian Federation and work to elevate the economic and social quality of life of these people, and to try and bring it into this conflict. And it's tough to tell somebody that when they're in the middle of it and they're suffering every day. So who the hell am I to say something? I'm thousands of miles distant. I don't wake up every morning to ongoing bombardment. But I respect where he's coming from. I have tremendous sympathy and empathy. But I just think he's wrong when he seeks to, impugn the motives of Russian leadership.
All right. H-E double hockey sticks word you used twice there, but not yet the F word. We'll see what happens. Our next question comes from Moscow, Russia, Samir Husseini. What is your opinion on the new Russian military base agreement in Sudan, and how does it affect the Arabian Peninsula, especially in view of the emerging Russia-Iran strategic relationship? What does this mean for Saudi Arabia?
I don't know anything about the news. Okay. What's that word we use, Jeff? We put that thing, the star-like thing. It's called an asterisk.
Yes.
Put that on this, and we'll get to that on Friday, because I'm going to have to do research into this Russian military base in Sudan. I'm not aware of it, and it's escaped my attention. Yeah.
All right. We'll come back to that on Friday night. Question number three. Note to self. Question number three.
Okay. He's probably sitting there going, why the hell do you have a show called Ask the Inspector if when I ask you a damn question, you don't know anything about it, son? You better do your research, do your homework before you get on air. I agree. I'm sorry.
No. I don't know is a great answer when you don't know.
It's an honest answer when you don't know. I don't know.
All right. Well, let's see. What does this say, I wonder? Well, one member of our audience has the following
Lucas
question.
Robertovich Novakovsky. He is Virginia Oblast, United States of America.
Very good. I'm impressed. Can you do an event at a Russian venue in D.C.? It would be fantastically fitting to have food in the same vein as what you ate in Votkinsk. I wonder what your following is in Virginia, Langley much, and Maryland. What does it look like there?
I think I'm surprised you didn't say, Fort Meade much after Maryland. The implication that the CIA and the NSA have an interest in me. If this is a serious question, I'd love to, but the question comes down to who would dare host it in Washington, D.C.? I was just at the Russian embassy for Defender of the Fatherland Day, and was confronted by a demonstrator on the way out, and we nearly went at it. it almost got violent. I was I had four shots of vodka, so I was not feeling patient, and the man insulted my daughter and a Russian lady who was exiting with us. I asked him not to. I asked him to be respectful of the women. He opted out, and he called me names. I don't care about the names, but when he called me killer, I guess the killer in me responded, and I told him, yes, I am a killer, and business is improving, and I'm looking forward to the opportunity to, and then at that point in time, my daughter pushed him away, and we exited, but I would like to see the security videotapes from the Russian embassy because I'm sure their security people are laughing their asses off at this stupid idiot American almost getting in a fight with a demonstrator. But the problem is that the cancel culture is big right now, huge. And I wouldn't want to, given the experience I had with the Russian samovar, I wouldn't want to subject any business to that kind of negative exposure. And it would be negative exposure at this juncture. Unless it could be done in private, similar to, again, what we did in New York City as Plan B, this wouldn't be a good thing. No matter how much I love Russian food and would love to relive the culinary experience of Votkinsk and share it with people, it's not me that's shying away from it. I just have to have respect, and I have to be courteous to anybody that might want to be a part of this. And the way cancel culture is right now, especially with the hostility. Jeff, newsflash, and I'm going to write something about this for Friday. Guess who's number one on the Center for Countering Disinformation list? The Ukrainian government has designated your inspector buddy, me, as the number one threat to Ukraine today. I'm it. I leave it. Currently, everything I say and do is deemed to be a threat to Ukraine right now. I mean, I'm joking about this. We're actually a little concerned about it because there's another list out there too, the Miratvorets list. They tend to kill people on that one. So getting highlighted on this might not be a good thing. But come on, you're gonna whip me for that. But
I don't activate it. I just start the 3 minute clock, and it happens automatically.
All right,
that's all I do. You don't think I'm pressing the whip button. I just start the clock. That's all I do. You know what? When you were said that you had an incident exiting the embassy, I thought somebody from within the embassy, and I think some folks in the audience got that impression too. So now we hear it was a demonstrator outside.
No, the embassy is not going to have the Russians were the kindest, sweetest hosts in the world. They were gracious. Yeah. And everything. And they were actually, because they didn't let us go out the front, because the front was packed with these demonstrators who were calling every woman a whore. I mean, come on, that kind of stuff. I don't care what you call me. They can call me anything they want.
How did they find out about the event? Was it public?
It's a national holiday. It's the biggest, one of the biggest holidays in Russia.
Oh, so even though they didn't get the detail, they didn't get an invitation to the event, they know something's going on that day.
Right? Oh, they knew it was going on. It's a big deal. And because it puts an emphasis on the Russian military, it was especially a big deal because, how dare you hang out with the fascist baby killers who are raping Ukrainian women and things like that. So,
looks like Xenia, who was threatening to come to Texas, is coming to Texas. That's how I take that message.
Oh, just so you know, Jeff, one of the things that we have to do is Xenia is going to take on Ryan in a Ask the Inspector trivia match. We have to pick 10 questions. We have to get little buzzers, and we're going to ask 10 questions. They buzz in, they answer, and we don't know what the winner gets or what the loser gets, but we're going to do that.
We'll figure it out. Okay. Yeah, I had a little exchange with Ryan about that. I didn't know if it was a serious idea or not, so I guess it is. We'll do it.
Well, because Ryan and I are doing the arm wrestling, that's the physical aspect of it. Yeah. But Ryan is a very diverse individual who has apparently a big brain inside that balding head of his. So he thinks he can match wits with a PhD candidate who speaks foreign languages, two of which are dead. And so I'm trying to give him the opportunity to do just that, pick 10 questions and see who gets the majority of them right.
All right. And before we get to Austin, we're actually going to be in Oakland. That's on the 18th and the 19th. So the info is flashing by right now. And you can get more specific addresses and so forth by going to scottritterextra.com. So,
and just so you know, Juan Rodriguez, who does a podcast, you've seen him, the former Marine, he's going to be there with his family. So we have to show them good hospitality.
Where, in Oakland or Austin?
Yeah. No, he's going to meet us in Oakland. He's coming up to see the event.
All right, and you're doing an interview this evening with a San Francisco podcaster, I believe. At least he's advertising.
Yes, so we're going to try and advertise this event. Now, that may be a mistake, but we're going to try. What part of cancel culture don't you understand, Inspector? They're going to cancel you if you advertise.
No, we have security, or our local organizers have security. So it's just part of the deal nowadays. We're not going to back down.
Well, we're not backing down.
Not at all. Sesh from Mumbai, India, thank you for your efforts to give us the whole picture. Is it possible that it is Slavophobia that allows the Western countries to be so unconcerned about the massive number of Ukrainian deaths?
Fascinating question. And I mean that sincerely. That's interesting, because he literally hits the problem on the head right there. There it is, real truth talk. That's Juan. That's my man. And he's with another guy named Angry Warhawk, who's a British guy, and they double team me and harass me. in a good way. But how America can justify this policy that we're undertaking, where we are sending arms over to Ukraine ostensibly for their defense, but the result of it is the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers, the deaths of thousands of Ukrainian civilians, the displacement of millions of Ukrainian citizens, the destruction over $1 trillion worth of Ukrainian infrastructure. Oh, how could we say we like these people, we love these people, we support these people? We're the worst thing that's ever happened to these people. We are literally the worst thing. So how do we, what enables us to get over this intellectual hurdle that allows us to treat these people with such flagrant disrespect and disregard? And that's an interesting proposition, that it's Slavophobia. We have Russophobia against the Russians, but do we really care about the Ukrainians, or are we just using them as a tool to get to the Russians, that we're happy this is a case where we get to kill Russians and Ukrainians? It's a good thing at the end of the day. It's not the first time we did that. We encouraged the conflict between the Iraqis and the Iranians back in the 1980s, because from our perspective, as long as they're killing each other, we win no matter what. And that's really what's happening right now in Ukraine. We win no matter what if we dislike both equally. Slavophobia. What a wonderful concept. Thank you for the question. I'm going to chew on that for a little while, because that is that's actually a very deep question. One of the deepest we've ever been asked. So thank you for that.
We get a lot of great questions from our
audience. We do.
Olga from Toronto. There seems to be three reasons for the US EU to pump the Zelensky regime with money and weapons. One, for the benefit of the military industrial complex. Two, land grabbing for the mining industry and agriculture. And three, lending for the benefit of the financial sector. What do you think Russia is likely to do about this theft of the wealth of Ukrainian people?
Well, I think the quickest way to solve this problem is to get rid of the Zelensky regime, in effect terminate all what you would call corrupt deals that were cooked up between the West and Zelensky, and create the conditions for the Ukrainian people to elect a new government that would lead Ukraine forward, free of the encumbrances of the military-industrial complex. There's these land deals going on, and I can't claim to have a full understanding of it. And to be honest, I haven't done the research necessary to actually say I know what's going on. But I've heard about land grabs where they're buying agricultural land ostensibly to be used as by big companies like Monsanto and others for creating DNA enhanced grains. Who knows? I can't claim to have the kind of knowledge necessary to responsibly answer that part of the question. But all of these deals are deals of desperation. These are deals being done by a corrupt government for corrupt purpose, and as such, easily nullified if Russia is to achieve the political victory and to do away with the Zelensky regime and is able to help facilitate the election of a new government. So let's see what happens. But I think that's the best thing Russia could do, is actually liberate Ukraine from the criminal conduct of its present government.
We just got a disturbing message that Germany is blocking the stream. So to whomever told us that, would you do me a favor and check each of our social media channels and let us know if they're being blocked everywhere? Because we're on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Twitch, and Rumble. And if you go to scottritterextra.com, click on Ask the Inspector, and there's links to every one of our channels there.
And Jeff, that's probably the secret that you were going to tell me, how I can get the links without.
As a matter of fact, it was. See, it all comes together. And another behind the scenes message, Kevin, please check the private chat. I just sent you a little message there. Thanks. Okay, so let's move on. Oh, well, I actually didn't mean to do that, but that's not a bad thing, as a matter of fact. Just a little reminder, Tim Kirby Russia will be with us on Friday night.
Tim Kirby of the Moscow Spartans.
That's right. That's the name of the American football team. And we're not talking about soccer. We're talking about NFL-style
We're talking American football.
That's right. The pigskin, as it were.
Knock 'em, sock 'em robots, baby.
We have a question from Chris in Florida, and that question is Victoria Nuland, with her husband's support, the current de facto U.S. president?
No. I mean, she isn't. Her husband, I believe, is Robert Kagan, a noted neoconservative. They are extraordinarily influential. Washington, D.C., you know, I mean, whatever term you want to use, if you say deep state, people go, oh, you're conspiratorial. If you say blob, which I've used often, they say, well, that's just too cute. So I just call it the permanent non-elected establishment. And they are part of the permanent non-elected establishment. You know, Victoria Nuland's been in the State Department, so she is actually a government official. And she has served in multiple administrations, Republican and Democratic alike. So, you know, she isn't there, you know, to do a political tasking. She's there to do an ideological tasking. And she's been very successful in this regard. I think you can basically say that, you know, she is one of the driving forces for what's going on in Ukraine today. And the reason why there is this horrific situation. I mean, if there were ever a Nuremberg type war crimes tribunal, Victoria Nuland would be one of the top people brought forward. And if found guilty, she's the kind of person you hang in by the neck until dead for the crime she has committed. She is horrific, but she is part of a team effort. There are many other horrible people out there that are promulgating you know, policies that lead to death and destruction. You know, one of the greatest crimes, according to Robert Jackson, I believe he was a Supreme Court justice who went on to be one of the senior people on the Nuremberg tribunals, is a war of aggression. And Victoria Nuland is promoting wars of aggression, which makes her one of the most horrific criminals in the world today. And she is responsible. She has the blood of so many people on her hands. And yet today we continue. I mean, she's going to get the Presidential Medal of Freedom at some point in time. She's going to be, you know, she has guaranteed sinecure in think tanks. She'll be in the Council for Foreign Relations. She's going to be around. And that speaks volumes about the quality of the American establishment. And I say that with all the sarcasm I can possibly muster, because there's nothing quality about the American establishment. It is an establishment that has lost its way fundamentally and no longer represents doing good for the American people or the rest of the world. It's about using the power of America to promote the narrow interests of a select few, among whom Victoria Nuland and her husband count as their number.
Okay. We're getting numerous reports from people in Germany that they have no trouble seeing us. So whomever said you're blocked, maybe pay your internet bill. That could be the problem.
Pay Hans, while you're
Hans from China, BRICS plus might bring down the U.S. dominance. Empires don't go down without a fight. What's the likelihood that the U.S. will just freeze all the BRICS members' assets as the final onslaught of a dying beast? And could that paralyze BRICS?
No, the U.S. wouldn't get away with that. They can freeze Russia's assets because they can claim that Russia has violated international law through its invasion of Ukraine. But they can't arbitrarily go out and freeze the assets of sovereign nations that have done that. There would be basically a global revolt against that, because it's just, even for a nation that wrote the rules, that would be such a massive violation of the rules-based international order that the U.S. couldn't get away with that. I do see that the U.S. will isolate countries individually and work on them. We saw that with Brazil, by the way, where without coordinating their response with the other BRICS nations, Brazil was coerced by the United States into casting a vote against Russia in the General Assembly of the United Nations. So the United States will do what it has always done, strong arm nations, use a variety of economic and political pressures to get them to behave in a manner that supports American policy, not opposes American policy. But at the end of the day, BRICS is becoming the most powerful economic forum in the world. It's surpassed the G7 in terms of real influence and such. And as it grows, he said BRICS plus, we're talking about Saudi Arabia, Iran. I mean, imagine that, get the Saudis and the Iranians together on the same roof with the Russians, and the amount of oil leverage they have on the global market at that point in time. And you know, China with its supply chain dominance and massive population and massive potential. India, same thing. So I think the, you know, there was a, I tweeted about it. There was an unfortunate incident at the OSCE where the Russian ambassador started to speak and everybody got up and walked out. And they were applauding how they isolated Russia. And I said, no, this is self-isolation of Europe and the West. Basically, understand that Russia is part of the world that doesn't like you guys. They're BRICS. They're the R in BRICS. They're part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Russia is a leading force in the real world, you know, the world outside of this narrow little circle that we've created between the United States and Europe. And so to walk away from Russia is just to further isolate yourselves. And that's the reality. The United States is going to have to figure out how best to manage its decline, but it can't reverse its decline.
Okay. Pat from Minnesota. Please explain what happened in Chechnya in the 1990s and what's happening now. At the start of the SMO, the Chechens were leading the charge. Is Russia losing the color revolution in Chechnya?
Well, I mean, in Chechnya, there were actually two Chechen wars. One that began, I believe, in January of 1993 and lasted until 95, 96. And another one that resumed in 99 and didn't finish until 2005. The first conflict, I think, was just part and parcel of the disintegration of the Soviet Union and an effort by certain Chechen clans, family groups, to take control of oil pipelines and oil generation capabilities to and the income generation that's derived thereof to enrich themselves. And it, they sought independence and the Russians opposed it. So there was a conflict. It didn't go well for Russia. The Russian army didn't perform very well. And then the situation again exploded in 1999. This led to a 6-year conflict in which, you know, the Russians won decisively. I mean, it was a brutal conflict, many, many thousands of dead. But at the end of the day, a certain element of Chechen society rallied around Russia, realizing that what was going on was that Chechens were being used by the West, and particularly the United States, as a vehicle to promote the disintegration of Russia. And so now these Chechens they've become sort of ultra-Russian patriots, and we see them. They supported. They provided a battalion of military police in the Syria operation of Russia, and they've taken the lead in trying to in generating volunteer forces for operations in Ukraine. I don't understand the question. Is the implication that somehow the Chechens are walking away from the Russians? I don't see any indication of that. The Chechens had a very active propaganda effort, but you've seen that has diminished once the conflict has become a Russian conflict. You know, prior to the annexation of the Donbas, the Chechens were there as volunteers supporting the Donetsk militia. But now the Chechens are there as part of the Russian army. And we've seen Chechen officers promoted into the corps. Aptia was given that honor. But the Chechens are there fighting. They're dying. But they're not relenting. I haven't seen any indication that there's any softening of the Chechen support. If anything, the Chechen leaders are encouraging the Russians to be even more aggressive, more assertive in their conduct of this conflict. But I don't see any signs of a divorce, any loss of a color revolution. If you don't think the Chechen government is 100% behind Vladimir Putin, I don't think you understand Chechnya, the Chechen government, or the reality of what's going on there today.
Next question is from Anon, from the planet Earth. I've visited there. Great place, to some extent. Does Russia have enough ammunition and ammunition-making capacity to finish the campaign before the deadline that you've been talking about recently? If not, can China supply ammunition secretly to Russia to help them win in time?
I want to remind everybody that I'm the guy that publicly came out when the rumors of Iran providing drones to Russia and said, I don't see the Russians taking Iranian drones. I see the Russians having their own drone program, and they would never subordinate their military capability to a foreign supplier. And I was wrong. So I'm about to say something, and I could be wrong because it's just analysis. It's, you know, basically educated guesswork. But I don't see the Russians giving China a de facto veto capability over the conduct of this war. And what I mean by that is for Russia to acknowledge that it has insufficient manufacturing capacity to generate the ammunition stocks necessary to fight this war on Russian terms and win this war on Russian terms, and then therefore they have to turn to China for the ammunition, it means that China, if it wanted to, could shut down the spigot if they wanted to slow the Russians down. They could say, oh gosh, the trains aren't running, we have a little, we can't get the things, and suddenly Russia's offensive is at the mercy of China. I don't see that happening. I also, my understanding of Russian shell manufacturing is that they're actually producing an awful lot of artillery shells. The problem isn't manufacturing capacity. The problem might be getting those shells to the front lines. You have to develop the logistical lines of communication. These are rail-based, road-based, et cetera. And that could be the issue. But the Russians aren't running out of ammunition. The only one running out of ammunition is the Ukrainians. And they will run out of 155-millimeter ammunition sometime this summer, and there's not a damn thing that NATO or the United States can do about it. And that is the death of Ukraine. Simply put, if they run out of ammunition, I mean, you know, we could be subjected to one of the greatest psyops in the world, psychological operations, propaganda, reverse propaganda, where they are convincing everybody that NATO, that they're running out of ammunition, and the Russians go, they're running out of ammunition. We're gonna pace everything based upon the eventual exhaustion of ammunition. And the Ukrainians are laughing the whole time going, no, we got a whole bunch of ammunition. We're joking. I don't think that's the case. I think they're running out of ammunition. I don't think there's any way to resupply them. I think the Ukrainians are in for a lot of trouble. They're already in a lot of trouble. They're fighting a war that's unsustainable in terms of casualty rates, et cetera. But it's also unsustainable in terms of the logistics, especially artillery ammunition. Russia, I don't believe, has an ammunition problem. I think Russia will be able to resolve this issue by itself. They don't need Chinese ammunition. They don't want Chinese ammunition. Of course, tomorrow we're going to find out that Russia just bought 100 million rounds of Chinese ammunition. And then, you know, I get to say, yay, I was wrong again. But I don't think I am.
So speaking of drones, I saw in the news today that there have been some drone attacks in Moscow recently. What do you know about that?
I didn't see Moscow. Look, the Ukrainians right now are you know, using these drones. These I think they're Tu-141s. They're rocket powered jet powered target drones. The idea was to launch them and then use them for radar tracking and the fire surface to air missiles to shoot them down. And with NATO assistance, and Vladimir Putin addressed this in his speech, with NATO assistance, they're being modified to carry out deep strikes into Russia. They were used to attack the Russian strategic aviation base in Engels. They appear to have been used in other locations as well. I didn't see anything about Moscow. That doesn't mean it didn't happen, because I've been pretty busy today, so I can't say.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe it was near Moscow, but in Russia anyway.
Well, no, definitely in Russia. And I think based upon what Carlos is saying there, you know, they're being shot down, but it's got to be a little disconcerting that that this is happening. But it's war. I mean, come on, man.
This has come up a couple of times in previous podcasts that drones could very well be, to some extent, a game changer. I mean,
I think they are a game changer, but I think Russia is the one that's actually mastered. Look, a handful of long range drones does not a war winning strategy make. It's politically embarrassing.
And unnerving if you live or work in the neighborhood.
Oh, no. I mean, talk to the Iranians and talk to the Israelis about how unnerving it was to have Iraqi missiles landing in your urban area in Tehran or in Tel Aviv. It's very unnerving. So, yeah, it's not a good thing. Plus, if you're the Russian leadership trying to project power and confidence and boom, there goes a drone going off in downtown Moscow. Not a good thing. But as the gentleman said, it looks like Russian air defense had those handled. But again, it's proof positive that Russia needs to win this war as quick as possible to bring attacks like this to an end.
All right, let's take one more of the questions that were submitted in advance. And if you want to submit a question for an upcoming episode, you can do that at scottritterextra.com. Click on Ask the Inspector when you get there, and you'll see how to do it. Also, please subscribe to our Substack. That's the address.
Can I say something before you read the question?
Well, it's a little bit unorthodox, but okay.
Koldal, I want to call her out. Koldal is an amazing individual. She flew from Greece to Washington, D.C. to participate or to be part of the Rage Against the War Machine rally, but she did so to hear me speak, and she was deeply disappointed that she didn't get to hear me speak. She attended the major reception afterwards, and we had a chance to meet and talk, and I'm very glad that we had that opportunity. And then she was very generous. She provided a very generous contribution that, and I'm just going to be straight up, it enabled me to go to the Russian reception last week. If somebody just Googles what it costs to take a train ride from here to Washington, D.C., back in hotel and all that kind of stuff, it's a lot of money. And I couldn't do it 2 weeks in a row because I had just done it for the Rage Against the War Machine thing. So the fact that I went there and I was able to write the article, give peace a chance, and we were able to have this kind of injection of discussion into this overall debate, the beginning of the Russophobia thing, is singularly because of what Koldal did. So I want to thank her very much, and I want everybody to know what she did. And I also want to point out that it's that kind of contribution that allows us to do the things that we're trying to do. So thank you very much, Koldal.
Yeah, I saw the exchange that you had on Substack with her. And I was starting to say that nothing is behind a paywall on our Substack, but a lot of folks choose a paid membership just to be generous, and we appreciate that.
We do, and we use it. I mean, it's like anything. It's pay bills so we can keep doing this. But and what she did was magnificent, and It made my day because I was able to do something that was cool as hell, which is to go to this Russian reception. But I was able to have conversations that I think further the overall goal and objective of bettering relations between countries. And I was able to produce an article that helped further this discussion and understanding. So, bam!
All right. Good job, Bobo. Let's show her some more love now by addressing her question. If Zelensky is removed as an obstacle to resolve the conflict, are there viable, authentic, people-supported Ukrainian leaders in-state or diaspora to replace him and negotiate?
I mean, there's definitely people that will replace him and negotiate. Whether they will be part of the solution is another question. I have a funny feeling that anybody who is remotely affiliated with the Zelensky regime is going to have to be subjected to denazification. And, the Russians learned their lesson. A lot of people don't understand the history of what happened in Ukraine from 1944 until 1954, 55. In that decade, the Germans and then later the CIA were using the Banderist movement as an insurgent army to fight Soviet authority. And this was bloody. I mean, over 250,000 Russians were killed. And I'm talking about civilians. Another 43,000, 45,000Russian or Soviet security forces were killed. And about 150,000, 160,000insurgents were killed. This is major war. And 150,000, 200,000 of them were captured and sentenced, given long sentences, political sentences, in 1944 or 1954, 55. In 1956, Nikita Khrushchev Went through his de-Stalinization phase, where he gave his secret speech to the Politburo, where he condemned Stalin, and is part of the reparations for the past sins. They opened up the gulag and they let these Banderists out, and they came back to Ukraine. And then they infected Ukrainian society for decades, leading to the situation we have today. And I bring that up because I just don't see the Russian government making that same mistake. I don't think that people are going to get a free pass. I think everybody's going to have to go through some sort of political purification test and a period of reflection, and is not going to be part of the rebirth of Ukraine politically. I think that, again, talking to Azarov, who is the former prime minister under Yanukovych, who is part of the Ukrainian government in exile, the indications are that there's going to be a 2 to 3 year period of military law where denazification has taken place, after which, once Ukraine has been thoroughly denazified, there will be elections, and the Ukrainian people will get to choose who their leaders will be. Obviously, the leaders will have to go through some sort of political purity test. I don't think you're going to get Bandera 2.0 brought in, but I think that's the process. And I know that's not the free and democratic answer that everybody wants, but it is the harsh reality of the situation that exists in Ukraine today. Western Ukraine is deeply infected with Bandera ideology, and it's an ideology that's rooted in generations, and it's not going to disappear overnight.
All right. Tip of the hat to Kevin Michalitzi, who's curating our questions and comments today. You like that? Curating, not just producing, not just the backstage duties, but curating. And let's go to some live questions coming in on Facebook and YouTube while Kevin lines up our first question. Let's remind folks that Tim Kirby Russia will be our special guest Friday night at 8 p.m.
Look at those eyes. Would you want those eyes staring at you across the line? Imagine him scowling and hissing and spitting and scraping the dirt and blowing snot out of his nose. And man, I love football.
Tim,
I'd love to line up opposite you and give you a chance to hit me.
But he told me he is the oldest player in the league. I think he's
how old is he?
I think he's 41, something like that. We can ask him on Friday night, but he told me he's the oldest.
I could beat him. I could go play one down. One down.
All right, what do you got, Kevin? Klaus from, what's NOK? Is that Norway? No.
Norwegian.
I get total silence.
I don't know.
Dryzen says Ukraine turn off air defense radars, invisible for all these abbreviations, invisible for Russia. Thus, Russia can't use aircrafts or take out moving targets. Thus, Ukraine can get supplies. Yes?
What?
I don't know. Too many abbreviations.
I know who he's talking about. Dryzen is an analyst. Who doesn't like me very well, I guess. But that doesn't matter.
It's Norway, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people respect his point of view. I mean, the implication here is that when Russia launches its attacks, that the Ukrainians shut down their air defense, so they're not giving away the radar positions. But and therefore, Russia doesn't know where their radars are, and therefore can't neutralize the air defense, which keeps the Russian air defense out of the Ukrainian airspace, which I guess buys a window of opportunity for the Ukrainians to bring in supplies. And I think that's just about as absurd as the day is long. I don't know Mr. Dryzen's military background. I know a thing or two about air defenses and taking down integrated air defense systems, having done it in real life. And that's just not how it works. And we see that. We see the Russians are actually doing some pretty clever things in terms of stimulating the air defense to come on by bringing in cheaper drones, etc., compelling them to waste ammunition on these drones. But there's a mix of, basically false targets and targets with warheads, so that you can't just shut it down, because then the ones with warheads are going to hit the target and blow up. So you got to treat them all equally the same. You shoot. The Russians are collecting. They followed up with another attack that's taking out the radars and the air defense. Russia doesn't need to put aircraft over Ukraine. That's not how they operate. All they need to do is take out the air defense so that their long-range missiles air launched and sea launched, can then, you know, have certainty of hitting targets. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing the Russians do some very innovative things with in their approach. This is a war. This is one of those, sort of sub stories to the overall conflict. Someday somebody will write a book about the air defense war, the games being played between the Ukrainians with NATO assistance to try and establish an effective air defense umbrella over Ukraine, and then the Russian efforts to counter that. And it's just too intense, and the Russians are enjoying too much success. You know, if Russia wanted to take out the rail lines, Russia would take out the rail lines. If Russia wanted to take out the bridges, they take out the bridges. If they want to take out the highways, they take out the highways. If they want to take out the tunnels, they take out the tunnels. It's not because the Ukrainians are preventing them from doing this. It's because Russia doesn't want to do it, because Russia's not at war with Ukraine. I don't know what part of that concept people aren't understanding. The fact that Zelensky every day gets to get up and breathe air is proof positive that Russia is not at war with Ukraine. Because if Russia were at war with Ukraine, Zelensky would be dead. So would Zeluzhny. So would the entire Ukrainian general staff. So would the parliament. Because these are all leadership targets that would be taken out. And it's the fact that they're not being taken out isn't that the Ukrainian air defense is wonderful because they shut down their radars. Makes no sense. But it's because the Russians know that the way to win, the whole Russian approach at the initial part of this conflict was to get the Ukrainians to the negotiating table, and it almost worked. They had three rounds of negotiations in Gomel, Belarus. They had a final round scheduled for Istanbul where they would have had a peace treaty, but NATO pulled them out. You don't negotiate termination of a conflict by killing the leadership.
Okay, way to go there, Kevin. Thanks for handling the backstage duties so aptly. No, ably, I think was the word I was looking for. We appreciate it. Candide Schmiles, thanks for the donation. The Kagan clan, our old Kievan mafia family, and controlled the National Crime Syndicate as head of the Brooklyn Jewish Mafia. Are you aware of this, Scott?
I've heard that. I can't say. I mean, I'm aware of that. I can't sit here and say that's factual. I've heard that before. I don't have any evidence to, I think it's clear the national origin of Kagan appears to be Ukrainian from Kiev, but whether or not the Kagan family is part of a Jewish mafia operating out of Brooklyn, I don't know. And if they were, I don't want to piss them off because I go to Brooklyn every now and then. And, so, hey guys, we're cool.
All right. Not looking for
that's joking. I pissed everybody else off. I might as well piss off the Jewish mafia in Brooklyn.
Right.
Just joking.
Another donation from Norway from Radar or Radar Barstad. 1, 2, 3 Baltics, 4 Poland, 5 Norway on assistance to Ukraine regime based on GDP. Coincidence or is the fee on increased profits from oil and gas?
Okay. Based on GDP. So he's implying that the top three countries, the Baltics, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, are the number one supporters of assistance to Ukraine based upon percentage of GDP, followed by Poland and Norway. Is this a coincidence or a fee on increased
profit? Unfortunately, before Scott answers the question, we have to figure out what the question is. So maybe if you folks can try to make your questions coherent.
I don't know. I mean, that's a fair question. I'm not denigrating the question itself. It's an interesting question. I'd have to do research on the issue of fees from oil and gas. I mean, how much money are we talking about to see if there's a correlation between the two? I can't do that right now. What's that word? Asterisk.
Okay. Yeah. Our next question from Mehdi, our friend Mehdi, a regular viewer of ours. Good to hear from Mehdi. Will Bakhmut become a sucking vortex of uncontrolled retreating men? I have submitted this question, and I am a subscriber, but I cannot find a way to submit my questions. Well, Mehdi, as I said before, just go to scottritterextra.com, click on Ask the Inspector, and read, and you will accomplish your goal. In the meanwhile,
he did.
All right. Well, he accomplished it this way. He will accomplish it this way, too. Go ahead.
All right, Mehdi. Well, it is a sucking vortex of, I don't know about uncontrolled retreating men, but it's certainly a sucking vortex of Ukrainian manpower, most of whom are dying, apparently. The rest are being wounded, and the others leave shell-shocked. Will there be massive retreating? I think what I read today is that the Ukrainians are doubling down on stupid and actually reinforcing Bakhmut because they're not ready to concede the inevitability of defeat, which it is inevitable. You're not going to get out of this one. The Russians have, basically, Mehdi found it. Boom! We have to look forward to more questions from Mehdi now. But there we go. So anyways, I think that we're going to see Bakhmut result in a decisive Ukrainian defeat, and unfortunately, going to be a lot more dead Ukrainians. But that's okay, because we love Ukraine. We support Ukraine.
Hoo-ah!
Now, on that note...
Eric Lassen has a question for you. What happens to you if you've deserted your position in Ukraine?
Well, a while ago, not much. I mean, that's why they had to pass certain laws. But now they've basically put the Kraken battalion and other nationalist battalions in the rear area, and they shoot you. So if you retreat and you leave your position, they'll shoot you. They'll arrest you. They'll execute you. That's that. And if somehow you slip through Kraken and you make it back to the rear area, they'll now arrest you and they'll prosecute you, and you'll get lengthy jail time.
That doesn't sound like much fun. That could ruin your whole day. Heels. How can people from Russia support your channel, since most of the payments are banned in here? Well, just sneak out of the country. No. Well, you're allowed to travel, actually, right? And we'll meet you in a hotel room and hand us a bag of rubles. Or is there another way, Scott? What about cryptocurrency?
I don't know. I tell you what. I mean, I'm not going to be facetious here. I think it's virtually impossible for Russians to support us financially. But I appreciate your offer. What we may do is, first of all, the fact that you watch and you listen is support. The fact that you're engaged is support. One of the main aspects of why I do this is not only to win over critical thinking on the part of Americans, but also to encourage the same on Russia and to expose Russians to viewpoints from the United States they might not otherwise have. So the mere fact that you're on here participating is tremendous support. Jeff and I will have a talk. One of the things that I've been thinking about is if there was a way to... to find an appropriate charity in Russia that people could donate to that charity on behalf of U.S. Tour of Duty. And that way we would do something, positive and constructive maybe something for Russian veterans or the children of Russian veterans or something of that nature, because U.S. Tour of Duty is about supporting U.S. veterans who have difficulty. So maybe there's something that we can do there. I don't know what the legalities of this is. I think right now the best answer is the fact that you're here engaging with us is really tremendous support, and we appreciate that. And if there's a way we can find a way to tap into, people's willingness to provide financial support, and do that appropriately and, in a way that doesn't violate the law, anybody's law, ours and yours, and isn't going to be misconstrued. That's another important thing, is not to get involved in something that can be used against us, because believe it or not, there's cancel culture out there, and they will jump on anything. Any mistake we make will be blown out of proportion. So we'll think about it. And again, I just like to express on my behalf my gratitude for the fact that you're here listening to us today. That's support enough.
And I concur. Let's take one more question from our beloved audience. And again, we really appreciate your support, whether it's monetary or just helping to spread the word. Thank you so much to everybody. Bob LeBlanc. I have seen a few videos of Eastern Ukraine, and it looks like spring breakup is already happening. Does this favor Russia or Ukraine?
I think by spring breakup, you mean like a thaw, like the end of winter, the beginning of spring. The Rasputitsa, the muddy season. Does it favor Russia or Ukraine? It favors the side with dominant military power, and that's Russia. Russia is going to be favored in any environment. I think people need to understand that this Russian conflict, Russia's participation in this conflict, is not calendar driven. People are like, we're the great winter offensive. The ground is frozen. Well, if Russia hasn't accumulated the resources necessary to sustain an offensive during the winter, they're not going to do a winter offensive just because the ground's frozen. They can't fight in the mud. Gosh, I don't know. Read the history of World War II. People fought in the mud. It's harder. It's more difficult. But remember, both sides are impacted by this. And the fact that we're not doing big arrow advances means that all Russia needs to do is continue to grind away. And they're able to do that. And then when the summertime comes, maybe they'll have the forces structure necessary to sustain meaningful offensive operations on terrain that's conducive to, broader maneuvers. But I think the fact is, regardless of the weather, Russia has distinct military advantages in terms of especially firepower, but also manpower and logistics sustainability. And I think that they're going to be able to apply these to their advantage, whether or not it's cold, muddy, wet, dry. Russia's got the advantage.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Ask the Inspector, the lightning rounds. Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. Join us Friday night for the loquacious version. And this week we have a very special guest, Tim Kirby Russia. So that'll be Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern time. We're in Oakland on March 18th and 19th. The Austin dates are March 28th, 29th, and 30th, and we'll have the specifics on that within the next few days. But we already have all the specifics on the Oakland events at scottritterextra.com. Scott is flexing his muscle. That is intended as a threat to Ryan and Austin, our follically challenged.
Not to Tim Kirby. Not to Tim Kirby. I'm not threatening Tim. He's too big.
You're not stupid, are you? Thanks to Kevin Michalitzi. Great job. We appreciate it. And to our beloved audience. And we will see you Sunday also on our other podcast, which is Scenes from the Evolution, which I co-host along with Kevin Michalitzi and Tori Mansfield. Thanks, Scott. Thanks to the audience. Bye-bye, everybody.